Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There, you're listening to Flop Culture. This is a podcast all about our favourite flops. And as we all know, flops, they're in the eye of the beholder. I'm your host, Fionnuala. I hope you're really well. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode. We're not here to talk about last week's episode. We're here to bring it back to the present and get into what happened this week. Coachella happened, weekend one at least. The biggest music festival in the world, arguably the biggest music festival in America and that continent anyway, happens over two weekends. The slowest selling year in history, I'm pretty sure. So in 2015, I think the first weekend ended up selling out in 40 minutes. This year, it took a month for the first weekend to sell out. And the second weekend, still not sold out. So if you're listening to this on the Thursday and you're like, do you know what I could do? I could do with a spin over to Indio right now. You could potentially still go, like, nuts. A lot of people putting it down to, you know, lineup is a little bit less buzzy. I would say you have Lana Del Rey on the tail end of an album campaign for Did You Know There's a Tunnel Under Ocean Boulevard, which I will say, incredible album. I don't want to say I struggle with Lana, but she's not an artist that I spend a lot of time with in the way, you know, she is this really dedicated fan base, but a brilliant album and by all accounts, an absolute slam dunk of a set at Coachella. And the bits I've watched, incredible. Go listen to that album if you haven't and watch the set. But Lana Del Rey, you know, coming to the tail end of an album cycle. Tyler, the Creator, also not really in the middle of anything, if I'm correct. Again, great artist. Brought out Childish Gambino. Lots of rumours about new Childish Gambino music from Donald Glover. Hugely exciting. And then we had Doja Cat as well. And Doja Cat, again, by all accounts, very good. Also coming to the end of an album campaign with Scarlett. I know she released the deluxe edition. I haven't gotten around to it yet. I didn't love Scarlett. I found Scarlett kind of hard, I will say. But a great performance. She's an incredible live performer. I'd love to see her live. It seemed to be the focus was on like heritage acts. You Have No Doubt. They seem to have gone down incredibly well. Yup, Gwen Stefani. I will say any clip I saw of her performing with Olivia Rodrigo felt really awkward. But if that felt more from Olivia's perspective, I don't really know. Especially when Olivia was claiming that they performed the song Bathwater together. And Olivia was saying she listened to it when she was very young. And she's a huge fan. I don't know if she just was trying not to overstep Gwen. I'm not sure. Any bits of that I was like a bit awkward, but what I saw of No Doubt themselves, incredible. Then you obviously have the likes of Justice, a couple of other acts, but it seemed to be like the new artists were the ones that won. So I did just want to take this you know, slot to talk about them. Sabrina Carpenter having the sunset slot on the Friday, I think it was. And again, I'm not sure if she's entering a new era or this is kind of just another last home run with Emails I Can't Send, that album, which again, if you have not listened to, go listen to it. Very good. Incredible performance with the Love Fool mashup and Feather performing the new song, Espresso, which I'm already afraid of my Spotify Wrapped because that is going to be number one. I've listened to that, I'd say, 45 times since it's come out. I cannot stop thinking about it. I'm excited. It's so funny because she has this massive back catalogue behind her and it feels like, oh, now she's on the climb. Now she's actually on the ascent to be like main pop girly. And you know why she does it? She has a very clear aesthetic. We can talk about the bangs and the blush all we want, you know, but she has that aesthetic, the way she looks, the artist persona of being like little freaky deaky girl, loves to, you know, loves to get her bit, wink, you know. It's standing to her because, you know, Espresso looks like it's going to be her biggest hit to date. It's incredible. The Coachella performance, incredible. I will say, if you're new to Sabrina Carpenter, can I recommend going back to some of her older albums? There's one called Singular Act 1, came out in 2018, and there's a song on that called Almost Love. And I'm a huge fan of that. So if you're just getting on the Sabrina wave, it's not too late. But please, please go back and investigate the classics, if you will. Chapel Roan, another incredible, like, her performance at Coachella was like watching, you know, when you watch a movie and it's about music or something and a band, and she did this song, I think it was for the song My Kink Is Karma, and she's speaking directly to the camera because obviously Coachella is like live streamed and filmed or whatever, and she's talking about she's shouting out her ex essentially and is like, this is for my ex because I know you're watching, and it plays like it's coming from a movie or something. It's just, again, to see this ascent for Chapel is incredibly satisfying. Her album, The Rise and Fall of a Midwest Princess, incredible. And to see it be, came out last year, it's this culmination of, she was signed previously to a major label, was dropped, and she's kind of been had just this onslaught, like it's been real album campaign coded. Like she said, like lots of, like a fistful of singles. They're all really, really good. It's Theatre Kid meets Gaga meets Cyndi Lauper meets Madonna meets someone else. Again, someone who has a really clear aesthetic hammered out for them, but also has the vocal chops and the songwriting. I'm furious I didn't get tickets for the Olympia. If you're selling tickets to Chapel Roan for the Olympia Theatre, DM me, please, because I would buy them off you. I love After Midnight on that Rise and Fall of a Midwest Princess album. But she's a new song out as well, and it is called Good Luck, Babe. And it's just brilliant. It's so... oh, I could talk about it all day. She's incredible. Go check her out. And then finally, she wasn't at Coachella, but I do just, while we're talking about music and we're in this headspace, I have to talk about Maggie Rogers and Maggie Rogers' new album, Don't Forget Me. I'm going to be honest, I didn't love the title track that preceded this. Like, it's a very good song, but it's not... how do I put this? She sounds incredible on it. I don't know. I was just like, okay, fair enough. Maybe this is a Maggie Rogers album that I'm not going to get into, because I kind of bypassed the last album as well, Surrender, whereas I would have been a big fan of her in a past life. I love Alaska, I love Light On. So this album came out, Don't Forget Me, and I was like, okay, I'll investigate it. Brilliant. The song The Kill, so, so good. The songwriting, again, really sharp. She sounds beautiful. She has such a command of melodies. I also love the song Soul Sick of Dreaming. This is very summertime vibes. This is very, we're driving, the roof is off in the car, a buzz. She's talked about this on her Instagram. She said the album is chronological and some of it is autobiographical. Some of it isn't for the first time. And it's, again, I love an artist and seeing them, hearing the potential on an album like Heard in a Past Life and being like, whoa, oh, we've got something here. We've got something here. And then seeing them fully realise it on something like Don't Forget Me. Incredibly satisfying. Is she playing? If she's playing Ireland anytime soon, can someone let me know? Because I would like to go see her. And if she isn't playing anytime soon, bookers and promoters, can we get on that, please? Please and thanks. What are you listening to? I know Taylor's coming. As we're sitting, speaking to each other, you're not speaking to me, I can't hear you. As I'm sitting, speaking to you and you're listening to me, Taylor's about to release a new album tomorrow. Is this her 11th? Is it her 11th? The Torture Poets Department. We are going to be talking about it on Patreon, so I'm not going to be talking about it here. And when I say talking about it, we're going to be talking about the music. I'm going to be talking about this insane lead up that we're seeing this week with all the Spotify, art installations. It seems like Joe Alwyn's getting it in the neck. That's all I'm going to say on that. I really thought this was going to be a Joe Alwyn, Matty Healy, it's on site album. Matty Healy, I'm not sure if he's even getting a mention in this album, which is that the greater punishment for Matty Healy? I think so. Anyway, are you listening to anything else? Is there anything else you think I would like? Any other music that you've enjoyed this year? Please let me know. It's hello@flopculture@gmail.com or we're on social media @flopculture_pod. Now, from the world of music to the world of competitive ballet, let's talk about this week's flop. Released in the year 2000, Center Stage promised to take audiences on a thrilling journey into that competitive world of ballet. With its captivating dance sequences and talented cast, it featured rising stars and seasoned performers alike. So, one would expect it to pirouette its way to success. But instead, the movie failed to captivate audiences and critics alike. Why was that? Joining me to discuss Center Stage is writer and beauty editor Aisling Keenan. Enjoy. Aisling Keenan, you are so welcome to Flop Culture. How are you?
I'm so buzzed to be on Flop Culture. I'm so excited. And I had, as soon as, like, from the moment you launched this podcast, I knew if I was ever given the honour of being a guest, I straight away knew what I wanted to talk about.
Right, well, don't leave them in suspense. What is it you wanted to talk about?
It's not just what I want to talk about here. It's what I want to talk about in life. The film Center Stage.
What a film. I'd never watched it before. And a real treat. Just very watchable, like great cast. Mm. I really enjoyed it. Was this like a more recent watch for you? Or did you watch it at the time of release?
No. I think it's 23 years old and I watched it. This is a funny story. I watched it when it first came out on VHS tape and I rented it from my local Extravision, right? And on videotape. And I rented it every weekend. So I think I was maybe like, if it's 23 years old, I remember being about 12. So that tracks. If my high level mathematics are correct. I rented it so often from my local Extravision that they actually took pity on me and gave me the VHS tape. I shit you not. They gave it to me. They literally were like, no one else rents this. You rent it every weekend. Like I literally would go in on a Friday evening with my dad. Like, I even know my Extravision number off by heart because if I didn't have the card, I'd panic. So it's like BX1931. Like, no joke. I'm not joking. Go into Extravision, you'll be able to rent on my card, like with that code. And I remember like every weekend going in and renting the exact same video and then bringing it home, watching it like 5 times across the weekend because there was no other way to access it. There wasn't the internet. I couldn't just go and like get a bootleg version off YouTube. VHS was my only access and Extravision was my only access. And I was addicted to this film. Like I was like down hard for the film. Like I just couldn't get enough of it. Age 12. And so they took pity on me and gave it just were like, look, no one else ever rents this. You can have it.
Everyone has an Extravision story and everyone who comes on this podcast has their Extravision story. And I'm absolutely thrilled by yours. What is Center Stage about for anyone who is not familiar?
It's the OG dance film is what I'm going to say. Like Center Stage walked so that Save the Last Dance could run. And like all the dance films that followed it, like Step Up and Step Up 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 18 and however many of those films they did. Center Stage was the original one. And it's about a group of ballerinas in New York City or ballet dancers, not just ballerinas, that are in ABA, which is the American Ballet Academy. And they're on the way to going to ABC, which is the American Ballet Company. Now, ABC doesn't actually exist. It's ABT in America. It's the American Ballet Theater. But it was very, like, I'm not even going to say loosely based. It was tightly based on ABT. Like, they even filmed it in Lincoln Center, which is where, like, American Ballet got like work from, I suppose, and that's where all their studios are. So it's like really, really basically set in that exact kind of environment. And it's about these dancers who are trying to graduate essentially from like the highest level student ballet dancers into the professional world. So they're kind of almost at their like beyond leaving cert kind of university, like they might be like 2 or 3 years into their university ballet course essentially, and then they want to get jobs as soon as they leave ballet university. That's kind of what it is. And they come from all over the country, and there's at the start of the film you see this whole audition process where, you know, the lead character, who's this girl called Jodie Sawyer, her parents are standing outside her audition for this academy, and they're like, they ask one of the other parents, they're like, so, you know, how many people can get through? And the one is like, 12. And she's like, oh my God, 12 from this class? That's pretty good. And she's like, no, 12 from the entire planet. And it like, the drama, like from the get-go, the drama kicks off. And it's really like, it's, you know, really competitive. And they really dig deep into like so many aspects of like the life of a ballerina and how difficult it is and how like the toll it takes on your body and your mental health and your social life and all this kind of stuff. And throughout the film, they're basically working their way up to this thing called the show, the workshop, which is essentially a show that they put on where they like perform at their best. And all of the different like ballet scouts from the school, the big schools around the country, come and see their final show and offer them jobs. And the dream job is the New York job. So it's getting into ABT, which is the biggest, like, you know, ballet company in the country. But then there's like the San Francisco school, or there's like the Chicago Ballet, or there's the whatever. So they're all basically working their way through this film, auditioning first of all, and then practicing for the workshop, and then performing in the workshop to hopefully get cast or get a job in one of these awesome dance schools. So that's kind of the...
Do you have a dance background, or was it like, what was it that was so compelling to you that you were like, I need to rent this every single week?
Yes. I don't want to go full like Julia Stiles, but I used to dance.
Oh my God, gas. I kind of thought you didn't, and you were just like, I liked like the, you know, it's no. A different world. Okay.
Like, no, interesting. Like I was passionately obsessed with dance from a very young age, and not just obsessed with dance, but like I fully believed that by now I would be living in New York as a principal dancer with a ballet company, even though I'd done absolutely shy all to get there. Like when I started to dance, I did like, I think I was probably, I don't know, 4 when my mother shoved me into my first Irish dance class, and I hated that. So then I started a different dance school, and I did like tap and contemporary, and then I did like hip hop and jazz, and you know, I did all the different ones all the way up, and I probably stopped. I you know, I thought I was too cool for it when I was about 18, and I stopped, and it's the biggest regret of my life, because
aww.
Yeah, I know, and like it was like I loved it so much. I went to competitions every weekend. I had so many friends from my dance school. I loved it so, so much. And I regret, like deeply regret giving it up. But yes, I was involved in the world of dance at that point. And so I think it had a special, like I had a bit of an extra special connection to it. Although I do know a lot of people who have never been involved in dance that still love it. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it's exclusively for dance weirdos like me.
No, definitely not, because it's, you mentioned obviously the step ups, and we've done an episode did an episode on step up 2, and like hilarious, incredible choreography. There's kind of nothing to it though beyond that, whereas like with this there's a lot more substance to it. It's, people are probably going to laugh at me for using this word, but in some respects it's a little bit grittier. And I think, I can't say this for every character, because not all of them are well drawn, but I think the ones that are and the ones that have space, the characters that you have space with, they're really compelling. And as I said, I like, maybe this won't sound like a compliment, but like it's so watchable. I read in some of the reviews that it was like, it was criticized for being like soapy, in inverted commas. Like the reason why soaps are so successful is because people tune in every fucking week, sometimes multiple times a week, to watch it, because it is so watchable. Describing something as soapy is not a critique to me. Like this is, this was very good and extremely watchable, I'll say again.
Like, I mean, I obviously love it deeply, and I have, it's one of those ones that, you know, You know, one of those films that you watch in your formative years, and even if it is the biggest piece of trash ever put to film, you still have such a love for it. And then you try and make something, like I made my husband watch it a few years back and he was like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is, this is shit. And it's problematic. And to be fair, there are a lot of, like, let's say there are a lot of things that would not be committed to film in 2024 in that movie. Like there are things that you're just like, oh, that would not happen now.
Mm.
But look, that's the case with so many pieces of, you know, things that were created in the 90s or early 2000s. But it is so watchable. And it is, like, I think even though it has a cult following in like the dance community, which I would not consider myself part of anymore, but like at the time I did, like I think I'm biased, but I do think you could just watch it now off its own bat and be like thoroughly entertained. Because aside from the kind of grittier parts, like there's stuff about eating disorders, there's lots of body image talk, there's lots of, you know, competition, and there's a lot going on. But aside from that, there's just incredible, incredible dance scenes. Mm. And like, you know, people in their early 20s hooking up and like just fun stuff. And then there's like a love triangle. Like, who doesn't love a love triangle? Truly, so I just think, there are, it's like you're watching it and you're like, this is awful, but it's so good. And like, I think one of the things as well about Center Stage is a lot of the actors, and this is what I forget sometimes when I'm watching it, a lot of the actors weren't actors. So they were dancers. And that's part of the reason why the dance community loves it so much, because they didn't hire regular people and then make them do shit dancing. They hired professional ballerinas and made them act. And the only one in the film that didn't, the only kind of major character in the film that didn't kind of have a professional dancing background was Zoe Saldana's character, Eva Rodriguez. And she got a body double, like a dance double for the filming. Now, Zoe Saldana did have a dance background, just not quite as, like, I mean, she's still a beautiful dancer, just not a completely professional ballerina like the rest of them were. But the whole rest of the cast were professional ballerinas. So, like, you can't expect them to also be, like, Oscar-worthy actors. So some of the acting was a bit clunky and a bit, like, eye-rolly and a bit kind of soap cringy in a sense. But, like, so what? It's so good at the same time, you know?
We have to talk about Zoe Saldana. This is her like film debut, and it's just, she is eating up every scene. Like, she is a character who I'm like, I'd kind of love to know your motivations a little bit more and like why you're like this.
Yeah. Give me your background.
But at the same time, she kind of sold it so well that it was like, you just got her immediately. You know what I mean? And she's just so, I don't know, like cranky and talk backy and hates authority, and she's just like smoking all the time, but she's clearly so talented, and you're watching her and you're like, you're really squandering all this talent. Like, why are you doing this? You've seen her stick up for Jodie. It's just, she's people haven't seen it, it's worth watching for Zoe's performance. For and her. As you said, not a huge dance background, but absolutely killing, especially that final act, which again, like, I think we can obviously spoil it, but it ends with the workshop, and Zoe isn't supposed to get a role, but she does. She ends up getting one of the leads. She takes over for Maureen because Maureen's like, I hate ballet, and is like, bye-bye. And it's just incredible. And she's selling it with her face and everything. They really hit all the nails on the head with the cast. Even I know the critics who wanted more of a movie and less of like a dance movie wanted more acting forward. They'll obviously critique that it's like it's dancers and not actors.
Yeah.
But I think they're pretty good. And I think the clunky parts you refer to as well, I think some of that has to do with the writing. I think, you know, I think sometimes you have a line, what are you going to do? Like, you know, anyone
would struggle with a line. There's a couple of like awkward scenes. They end up on a ferry at one point, and there's like Charlie, who is one of Jodie's love interests in the love triangle, he's like
hot, by the way. Oh, sorry, listen. All the love interests, hot.
Hot
cast.
Yes. And like, they're not hot technically, but they are because of who they are. Like, as in Ethan Stiefel's character, Cooper Nielsen, shouldn't be hot, but he really is. And you
just
really want,
he's a bit of a weapon.
He's a bad boy. He's the classic bad boy.
Bad boy, ballerina, love it.
But Charlie, yeah, Bad Boy Ballerina, like it's such a like, yeah. But Charlie is like the good guy of ballet, and he's the one everyone likes. And there's a really funny scene where all the girls come in to the hall to kind of look at the new guys for the year. And they're all like, oh my God, look at him, because he's so like obviously attractive. And then one of them is like, gay or straight? And they all go, straight. And they're all like buzzing because finally there's a hot straight ballerina in their midst. Like they're just absolutely jazzed. But yeah, they're on the ferry at one point and like Jodie and Charlie are having the chat, and it's just, you're literally like, give these people better lines, because you know they can deliver if they want. And like Amanda Scholl went on to be a very successful actress, even though this was one of her first film roles. She did go on, like she was in Suits, and like she has had a pretty successful career as an actress, completely aside from dance. So we know she can act, but like, you're right, the writing is a bit turgid at times, I think.
Yeah, for sure. How do you think it compares to other films of the genre? I suppose we could go really specific about ballet, and then I suppose widely, again, all the ones we mentioned, Step Up, Save the Last Dance, Honey, one of my faves.
Honey, iconic. Oh my God, I love Honey. I love that final scene in the refurbished church.
Slay.
I think it stands apart from them all because it is about ballet, first of all, and it's very much focused on the dance, right? So in Honey and in Save the Last Dance, you've got like the societal issues in Save the Last Dance, and you've got the white girl in the black community, and you've got all that going on, and you've got the dead mother, and you've got the dad, and, you know, she's coming into the big city, and like you've got, there are like five storylines, then you get to the dance bit. And you get to, she's only learning to dance via your man. Like it's not really, yes, she has a dance background, and yes, there's like, they're dancing in the club, and they're, you know, she's auditioning at the end for Juilliard or whatever, but like dance is not the primary focus. And same with Step Up, like you've got Channing Tatum is like from the wrong side of the tracks, and he's cleaning in this dance school, and he's, you know, whatever. But like, there's like four storylines and then you get to the dance. Whereas Centre Stage is unashamedly about dance. Like, yes, the other storylines are there, but they're very much the second fiddle, and like the dance is front and center. Like I would imagine if you'd like, I don't know, I've never done it, shocker, I've never done it, because I probably should have by now, but like if you've timed the amount of dance, like actual dance scenes in Center Stage between rehearsals and shows and workshops and whatever, like it's a significant portion of the film. And the other storylines, like the love triangles, they're facilitating all these dance scenes. Like literally the love triangle between Cooper Nielsen, Charlie and Jodie, like has to culminate in a dance scene for it to work out, you know, like that's, they literally solve the love triangle complications live on stage. Like that's literally where the love triangle is completed, and that's where they fix it, and that's where she decides she wants to be with Charlie, and that's where she decides that yes, she's going to join Cooper Nielsen's company, but she's not going to go out with him because he'd be a shit boyfriend. And it's so, the dance, I think that's why it stands apart from other dance films, because it really is the essence of what a dance film is. And I realize I sound like such a fangirl, but I am.
It's completely okay to fangirl here. If you're not fangirling on pop culture, where are you fangirling? Right. How did they get the bloody motorbike on the stage for the last dance? That's all. I was like, Jesus Christ, the insurance is through the roof here.
And you know what? That wasn't in the original script, right? So, So insider info from an interview with Ethan Stifel. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce his last name. If you're listening, Ethan, I do apologize.
Sorry, Ethan.
But he was a motorbike, like he was he really was the bad boy of ballet, because he did drive motorcycles on the side, and he used to drive them up to like the set and stuff. And when it came time to do that scene, they were like, well, how better to, you know, illustrate a bad boy than with a motorbike on the stage? So but it was one of the producer's ideas, because they knew that Ethan as a real life man had an interest in motorbikes. So there's a fun fact.
There you go. So interesting. Motorbikes take up.
I was going to say, I don't know the logistics of how they actually got the motorbike onto the stage. That is not something I'm privy to at the moment.
Okay. Well, Ethan, again, if you'd like to call in and explain, I would appreciate that. Motorbikes take up such a huge part of several flaps we've covered, because again, motorbikes feature heavily in Grease 2, which we did with the American Glycite.
Yeah.
Like, we need to do some research into that. I'm not sure. We've kind of touched on a few things that didn't maybe necessarily work for us. Was there anything else for you that even on maybe a recent rewatch that you're like kind of cringing at, or just like just fundamentally kind of takes it away from being like a perfect film?
Yeah, well, like there's a little bit of kind of sexism. There's a little bit of like, you know, just, I mean, it has its problems. There's a lot of, like I said earlier, there's a lot of talk about body image. Like there's a big focus on body image, particularly because one of the lead characters, Maureen, has clearly got an eating disorder and is eating food and then throwing up everything. And, you know, it's witnessed a few times throughout the film by friends. And like, there's this incredibly disturbing scene right at the end where throughout the course of the film, Maureen is clearly struggling with her body image and her weight and the intense pressure that the ballet school puts on her to be a certain size and to look a certain way. And they do that to all the dancers. And that's something that is problematic, but I know exists, and I know it still exists. And whether they'll admit it or not, like there are, I mean, you can't be a plus size ballerina. That just, you won't get hired. You won't get featured in shows. That's just not something that happens. Like even now, the kind of more, I suppose, muscular ballerinas that are around now, that kind of have that bit of meat on their bones, like they still are few and far between. And so at the culmination of this whole eating disorder storyline for Maureen, her mother is chatting to her about why she decided not to dance in the final show. And Maureen is like, "Mom," like, obviously I'm paraphrasing here, but she's like, "Mom, I fucking hate ballet. I don't want to do it. And it's making me like actually sick. I'm unwell.
Yeah, it's
like,
making me ill. Yeah.
It's making me sick." Like, and her mom is like, "You watch your weight. There's nothing wrong with that." And you're literally standing there going, you want to punch that woman in the face, because you're like, your daughter is standing in front of you telling you that she has like serious issues with her, like this eating disorder. And like, you're like, "Oh, it's you're just keeping an eye on your calories." Like it's so bad. And it's, but you know what? There's a part of me that's like, even as a 12-year-old, I remember being like, well, her mom's obviously an arsehole, because I remember they don't make that seem okay in the film. But I still think it would be better if that storyline was a bit more like well-rounded, or if they addressed it with a little more care or something.
Yeah.
I think it can, like that was very dismissive of it at the end. And and even when her boyfriend, Jim, discovers that that's what she's going through, it's not really, I don't know, they don't get into the meat of it enough. They need to kind of get into it a bit more and really kind of make sure it's crystal clear that, you know, that shouldn't be happening and that's not okay. And she needs help and she needs support and she doesn't need to be starving herself or throwing up everything she eats to be a ballet dancer. I think that needs to be a little bit clearer. I'm trying to think what else doesn't really work. I feel like your one Juliette Simone, she's like the posh French, like mammy of the ballet school, I suppose. She's like the lead female teacher. There's like a really funny scene where Maureen's mom is like, "Juliette Simone, please. Her name is Julie Simon and she's from Perth Amboy and her father manages a Walmart." And it's just like, it's so classist, you know, and it's so like, if she's not legitimately Juliette Simone, she can't possibly have the skills to teach ballet. And I just think it's a bit classist and a bit like shitty, because the woman is clearly incredibly talented and, you know, whatever. But yeah, there's that. And then I don't know, like there's this a funny scene where they all.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Go to a nightclub and there's like some Russian stereotyping going on of one of the characters, which is a bit awkward and a bit shit as well. But I mean, overall, I don't know why it flopped, you know. I don't know why it wasn't in every cinema, and I don't know why it immediately didn't get rented out by everybody who lived in Swords in 2002 or whatever year that was.
Well, thank God they didn't, because you wouldn't have been able to watch it then.
Absolutely not. I would have been like, honest to God, if I had gone in there any Friday night and that video hadn't been available, I would have been like, my weekend meltdown would have. Yeah. Oh my God. Like literally it would have been just The Sims 24/7 with no break for center stage. That's what my life would have been. It would just have been Sims, no break, more Sims, because that's all I did back then, was play The Sims and watch center stage.
Yeah, what a life. What a life. Doesn't sound bad.
To go back to it.
Oh, truly. You mentioned that, yeah, it didn't really do as well as, I don't know, it kind of would have been. And again, I watched this and I was like, I'm really surprised that this didn't do better at the box office. Opened at number 6. Ended up grossing worldwide, I think it was $26 million against a budget of, we don't know the specifics, but it was between, I think it was $18 million and $28 million. So like, we can presume that it definitely did. If it made a lot of money, it did make a lot of money, but it probably lost money.
Yes.
And the critics, oh my God, the critics just did not like this at all. Like the Rotten Tomatoes critics consensus reads, viewers willing to sit through soapy plot contrivances to see some excellent dancing might enjoy center stage. For everyone else, there's still always Fame. Fame came up so regularly in like comparisons to this, which like I get, and I don't know, I get and I kind of don't, you know?
Like I get it in the sense that they're both set in performing arts.
Yeah.
School settings. I do get that. But Fame is nothing like center stage, like, because Fame doesn't center around dance at all. So it's comparing apples and oranges, but not apples and apples. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, they're both dance films ish, but nah, not really.
Roger Ebert was way kinder. He actually gave it a three out of five stars. And he said, center stage has moments of joy and moments of insight. And is about both human nature and the inhuman demands of ballet, which I think like, very correctly sums it up.
Yeah, it does. Because they are inhumane and there's so much human nature. Like there's, like even over the years as I've watched it, because I haven't stopped watching it, as in I started age 12 and I'm 36 and I still haven't stopped. I watch it regularly. And I still find bits of like clarity and bits of like little moments where I'm like, oh, that's actually, yeah, that's still, you know, still tracks now, or it still makes sense now or whatever. Just like the competitiveness, and you could really apply a lot of the situations to any like industry, or I don't know if you'd call it the dance industry or dance and industry, but you know what I mean? Like you could apply some of the lessons that are within it to lots of different areas of life. So yeah, I feel like I don't know why it wasn't more of a success. I really don't, because I guess people probably were put off by the concept of a dance film, and like it will, like people probably thought, okay, well, it's only going to apply to me if I'm interested in dance. And maybe that's why it got that cult dance following, but didn't go like super mainstream. And as well, I feel like the cast, as well cast as they were, because they really bloody were, there was no like huge names. Like,
yeah, Zoe I was Saldana, just about to say.
Yeah, like Zoe Saldana now is famous, but like there were no like super A-list people like hooking people and getting people into the theaters. Like they could have made you know, Charlie's character be someone a bit more famous, but then they would have had to get another dance double. So I guess they were trying to stay, you know, close to their actual legit dancer roots, which is understandable and fair. But like, there was no big celebrity hook to get people into, like, get bums on seats, essentially. So that might be another reason why.
I had asked you before coming on, I was going to ask you if there was a sequel that you could see happening, not realizing that there actually had been, there are two sequels to this movie. Now, they're not direct sequels, I'm pretty sure. So the first one is Center Stage, Turn It Up, classic. That came out in Australia first in October 2008, which should say everything.
Yeah.
And then came out in the States a bit later on. It was like a straight to TV kind of thing on the Oxygen channel. And then in 2016, we had Center Stage On Point, but obviously spelled like the ballet way.
Yes.
And that was another made for TV kind of thing, featured someone from Dance Moms who I'm not familiar with. And it featured alumni from the first two films coming back to teach like a new generation of dancers. Have you seen them? Do you enjoy them? Are they canon to you, or are you, are they, should we be doing them next on Flop Culture?
No. Okay, let's brilliant. Not watch them. Let's not, because do you know what? I'm a purist. And when they cannibalize the success or the cult status of Center Stage and then just tack on a number and a jazzy new name and try and recreate the magic. The magic is never coming back. Like, the magic is never going to be recreated there. And with sequels, say like Grease 2, you had Michelle Pfeiffer. Like, that's going to work because Michelle's an icon. Like, you're not going to recreate the magic of Center Stage because none of them were iconic in the first place. None of them were like super, super A-list or even B-list or C-list or D-list. And so it's an island. Like, it shouldn't be recreated. It shouldn't be sequeled. You can't recapture that magic. Like, once the genie of Center Stage is out of the bottle, there's no getting him back in. And for that reason, I'm staying away from any and all sequels.
I'm out.
Yes, I will not be investing in any of those sequels.
They are, I will say there's been no further word on this since, but in 2020, there was talk of them doing like a TV adaptation, which I actually do think could, like, I did really like the movie, but in some ways I was kind of watching it and I was like, this could have been really well plotted out as a series as well. But in 2020, they were supposed to be doing a follow-up series. It was with the Sony Pictures, and it was from the Sweet Vicious creator, Jennifer Caton Robinson, Lawrence Mark. He produced on the original film and the two sequels. Uh-huh. There was kind of no word on talent, no word on plotline, bar that it was going to be a continuation of the original film set today. So contemporary film within the highly competitive world of dance follows a new inclusive class of dancers as they work to stay at the academy and clash against the traditional students and style the ABA is known for. And Cooper Nielsen is supposed to be at the helm of ABA and the ABC. Changes on the horizon in more ways than one. But when I say there has been not an iota of word since, so I'd say someone took one look at that and then the pandemic happened and they were like, back on the shelf with that. You emailed, you saw the deadline headline and you were like, hey guys, what if we don't do this? Thanks.
How about
I think the fuck not.
How about no? Like, seriously, the cult community that follow this film would be up in arms. I am the leader of the fan club. No, I'm joking, I'm not. But I'm sure there is someone very passionately in favour of no more Center Stage related content ever, please. Because except in like theoretical, you know, wouldn't it be great if this happened in the, like, fan fiction basically is all I'm here for. I am here for fan fiction featuring the original characters, featuring the original actors. But I'm not here for any changes. I don't want someone to be recast as Cooper Nielsen in any real way other than like in my brain for like theoretical purposes.
So fair. I don't think anyone could take over from Cooper Nielsen. That actor Ethan Stifel Sled.
Oh.
Stifel, whatever.
Like the scene, please tell me that you remember what I'm referencing here. The scene where, so Jodie decides, she's so fed up of the ballet classes and she's bored and she needs some excitement in her life. So she decides to like go downtown to like Brooklyn or some other scary borough of New York. And she like joins this jazz class, you know, off the side of the road. And of course, Cooper Nielsen walks in the middle of the warm up.
Yeah.
And There's like, what's the iconic, sorry, we haven't even touched on the soundtrack to this film, but I digress. So they do their warm up, and all the way through, the camera just focuses on Cooper Nielsen's crotch. That's literally all I could see. Yeah. Even as a 12-year-old, I was like, oh my God, look at it there. And they do this amazing like warm up, and then they do a dance in this class. And my God, like, if you didn't fancy him by that point, it would be then. That would be the moment where you're like, okay, we're in here. This is bad. I'm in love. And he's such a dick that, like,
he's such a dick.
Such a dick. Start to finish, top to toe. Like, it never eases off. There's no redemption arc for him. Like, he just continues to be a dick until the very end. But like, you still kind of love him. You're still like, yeah, and maybe she should get with him, and maybe her life would be miserable, but maybe that'd be artistic and sexy, you know? Mm.
We should talk about the soundtrack because it is so good. Jamiroquai.
Oh, good.
Pretty Young Thing. Yeah. Fun fact about this, I Want to Be With You by Mandy Moore is part of the film soundtrack. And it's Moore's highest charting song in the US at number 24. Like, she never had one after that. It became her only top 40 song in the nation. Spent 16 weeks on the Billboard Hot 100. Crazy.
That's because it's iconic.
Yeah, fair. Oh, no arguments here.
I don't even think it's in the film. I think it's, oh no, maybe it is. I think they like redo it at the end, maybe. But yeah, like there's so many good songs. There's another one by Mandy Moore. Is it Candy? Yeah. I think Candy by Mandy Moore is the one that they sing in that dance class, if I'm not mistaken. Why isn't that on the soundtrack? I've just realized that.
I don't know.
Because it's definitely, we're dancing friends forever. I can get used to this girl can dream. Yeah. They definitely, the warm up song, and it's a TikTok phenomenon. Because if you look up Centre Stage on TikTok, you will see all of these people who are fans of Centre Stage, and Candy by Mandy Moore starts playing and everyone jumps up and starts doing the warm up from the dance class. I do it all the time. Like, I'll just be in my kitchen and all of a sudden I'll just be like, and down and clap. Like, I literally just start doing the warm up. It's actually psychotic. Like, it's not normal. It is not normal.
I'm obsessed with your commitment to this film and this commitment to this fake warm-up. Unbelievable.
it's just iconic. Just, that's all I can say about it. It's so, like, it's just brilliant. And yeah, then you've got like Michael Jackson. I'm just looking at it here. And what's the one? Why isn't that? If I Was the One. Sorry. That If I Was the One is the like R&B slow set like song that they... The love triangle is kind of, it's kind of Charlie's opportunity to like woo her on the stage. And they're like, there's like slow dancing and they're like spinning her around in the air. And like, they literally, it's not even like art imitating life, because it's so literal. They are quite literally passing her from Charlie to Cooper Nielsen, to Charlie, to Cooper Nielsen, and spinning her around between the two of them. So it's not even a metaphor. It's just literal. We're in a love triangle. Let me spin you between these two men. Literally. Like, it's so like straightforward. But that song is iconic. And then Can't Heat. I mean, it's just like, yeah, I would listen to the soundtrack and frequently do just on the regular. And sometimes like maybe I reenact some of the scenes.
Maybe. Who could possibly say?
Who's to say? Who's to say?
Who knows? Aisling, what a pleasure it's been. Before I let you go and we talk about your wonderful Substack, The Outfluencer, ultimately, why do you think this flopped?
Because people didn't understand it. People thought, this is a dance film. I don't understand. I'm not interested in dance. Therefore, it is not for me. They didn't think for a second that they could enjoy something that, like, I'm trying to think of like an American football film, like what's that one with Tom Cruise and Show Me the Money, you know that one? Jerry Maguire. That's about American football, right? So like I remember as a kid being like, I'm not watching that. I don't care about American football, but it's an iconic film. Like it's iconic. So I think the combination of a misunderstanding about whether someone would enjoy a dance film if they've no interest in dance, and also the fact that they didn't have any like box office bums on seats celebrity in a leading role. If they had, I think it would have done big money at the box office. Like, if they had got someone in the lead that was like mega famous at the time, I think it would have done great. And on that, I did recast the film in 2024, if you're interested.
Of course I am. Tell me.
So, Timothée Chalamet is Charlie.
Yeah.
Straight
immediately, yes. Immediately, immediately, yes. Immediately, yes.
I'm looking at Glenn Powell for Cooper Nielsen.
Yeah.
Because
he's sexy. You've done this so well, two for two.
Thank you. Because he's sexy, but he's also a bit of a dick, and he can play the bit of a dick really, really well.
Yeah.
And if we grew his hair a little bit and got him in, like, yeah, look, the man is in shape, but if we got him into ballet shape.
Ballet shape, yeah.
He would do a really good Cooper Nielsen. I think Zoe Saldana, because the woman has not aged a day in 23 years, she would retain her role as Eva Rodriguez because she was so iconic. And then I'm thinking, I'm going to go out and say Nicola Coughlan for Jodie Sawyer, because I just think she has the vibe. Like, she just, there's something about Nicola Coughlan that gives me Jodie Sawyer vibes.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And I think, was there somebody else I wanted to cast? I think I wanted to cast, you know, the guy who's the owner of the school. I can only think of his real name, which is Peter Gallagher. And I can't think of his name, his character's name.
Jonathan. Or Sandy Cohen, if you watch The OC. Because when he turned up, I was like, what? Sandy Cohen? What are you doing in this ballet school?
Sandy Cohen can dance? What? Yeah. So, Jonathan, I wanted to cast Bradley Cooper as Jonathan. Yes. So now we might have to dye his hair a little bit. But I feel that's like fine. Bradley Cooper has the kind of, like, he's just kind of camp enough to be like the head of a dance school while also being someone that all the younger dancers would obviously fall in love with. Mm. And like, he's just old enough to be in charge, but young enough that you might be able to get with him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so fair.
That's who I wanted to cast for that. And I think that was it. I think those are the ones. Like, Timothée Chalamet, like, came to me like a fever dream. I literally was just like, he's Charlie, like 100%.
What about Maureen? Because she is, obviously, she has that ongoing difficult storyline. But like, when you kind of meet her, it's like, you kind of think she's the enemy. And then you obviously realize that she's not. And she's just going through it. And to see her kind of transition out and be like, you know, there's more to life than dance. So you'd need someone who, like, kind of initially you can't really sympathize with. But then at the end, like, you're fully rooting for her.
Yeah, you need someone who's kind of a bit of a bitch, but then you like them in the end. I'm like, who is like that in young life?
Who's brunette and knocking around?
You know who might be good, but we'd have to dye her hair.
Okay.
You know your woman, Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yes.
Now we'd have to dye her hair. But like, she has...
That's fine. We have loads of leftover budget from Bradley, so it's fine.
Grand. Perfect. So yes, okay. So we've loads of leftover budget, so we'll get her a hair... We'll get her like a hair person, and they can dye her hair safely and without breakage. And they would dye her hair dark. But I think she has that, like, when you look at her, you think, well, she's going to be a raging bitch. And then she's actually not, you know? So yeah. I think she'd act that really well. And I feel like, you know, in The Queen's Gambit, she's like kind of almost a bit alien, and I think Maureen has that kind of almost an alien quality about her, because her talent is so like ethereal and not lifelike that you're like, okay. So I feel like she'd be a good vibe, but again, big box die job to happen.
Oh my god, I need this to happen more than I need air to breathe, I think, now that we've spoken it out loud.
Like, but at the same time, I stand firm on not wanting it to be cannibalized by a new... I don't want them to remake it. I want them to leave it as it is, because they keep remaking. Like, the classics of my childhood keep getting remade, and it just makes me angry. Like, I'm like, no, leave it alone. Mm-hmm. I want it to stay the same. And maybe that's a sign of my age, but I just don't want things to change. And I especially don't want Center Stage to change. It's iconic. And yes, it was a flop, but in my heart, it will always be the best film that has ever been made.
Well, I'm really glad you picked it and brought it to my attention, and I got to watch it because I thoroughly enjoyed it, as I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. Talk to me about The Outfluencer. For anyone who's not familiar, what is it about? Where can people find that?
Yes, so The Outfluencer is my Substack, and Substack is basically a big old website where creators go to create and get paid for it, essentially, because as we know, when you work in a creative field, getting paid is not always the easiest thing to do. So this is like, it's basically, I'm trying to bring, I have a background in magazine journalism, and I'm trying to bring that kind of women's glossy feature-led magazine online every week. So I put up a piece every week, and it's essentially reads like something you might see in Elle or Cosmo or one of those women's glossies that we all love so much that are disappearing from the stands at an alarming rate. And you can find it at ashlingmkeenan.substack.com, or you can just Google The Outfluencer. And the name The Outfluencer basically comes from the fact that I am influencer world adjacent, and yet I'm not an influencer. So it's my play on that whole world, I suppose.
It's great. I will link it below for anyone who wants to subscribe. And I would recommend the Ozempic diary and the piece about kind of resentment over not getting a particular job. Two yes. incredible pieces. Would very much recommend them.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you read them. And I like the Ozempic diary was terrifying to read. Like when I got that interview back, I was like, oh my God, this is scary bananas. But yeah, very, very interesting. And nobody was really talking about Ozempic in such honest, straightforward ways. It was good. It was good to do that interview. So thank you for reading.
You're so welcome. Ashling, thank you for joining me on Flap Culture. I can't wait to chat to you next time.
What an honor. Thank you so much.
Huge thanks to Ashling. I'll leave the link to her Substack below. It's called The Outfluencer, and I would highly recommend it. And also I'll leave her socials if you want to follow her. Finally, Top of the Flops this week.
You're a flop. Flop.
Top of the Flops this week is Drake, because the man is fighting with everyone. The man has no friends left, right? So again, rap beef, kind of a staple of the genre, rappers having a go at each other through song, through raps. I love it. I absolutely adore it. But the issue is it needs to be done well. And in this case, it's not really doing enough for me, right? But if you're confused as to what's going on or how we got here, how Drake is scrapping with everyone, come along with me. Take my hand. I'll bring you, right? So Future and Metro Boomin. Future is a longtime collaborator of Drake's. They had a joint EP album together called What a Time to Be Alive, which is very good. If you've never listened to it, I would recommend. And Metro Boomin, longtime big rap hip hop producer. He actually executive produced that mixtape. Mixtape is actually the correct word, not EP. Sorry, don't come for me. He actually executive produced the mixtape What a Time to Be Alive. They ended up releasing this kind of, it kind of read like a breakup album to Drake, because obviously they're longtime friends, longtime collaborators. So they release this EP, and it's called We Don't Trust You. And it's filled with a lot of subliminal messages seemingly directed at Drake, but it actually wasn't Metro or Future that was responsible for kind of really kicking off everything here. It was Kendrick Lamar. Kendrick Lamar is featured on a track called Like That. And it went to number one in the US. It was there for 3 weeks, probably a little bit longer actually now at this point. On it, he talks about a reference that J. Cole made on a collaboration he did with Drake previously, in which he talks about the fact that Drake, J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar are considered the big three in terms of this current era of hip hop and rap. Like they are the top three ever, right? Kendrick was like, nah, I don't think so. So he says in this song, Like That, he says, motherfuck the big three, it's just big me. So he's like, I don't want anything to do with to you, right? Again, having a go at Drake, he's like, because Drake is constantly referring to himself and comparing to himself to Michael Jackson, right? So Kendrick again is like, your best work is a light pack. Prince outlived Mike Jack, as in he's Prince, Drake is Michael Jackson, right? Are you following? Okay. So then J. Cole follows that up, right? On, this is maybe actually the most embarrassing. Maybe J. Cole should be top of the flops. Let's lump him in here as well, because this is embarrassing. If you're going to commit to a rap beef, commit. Don't be putting out a song and then deleting it, right? Which is exactly what he did. April 5th, he comes out with a track called 7 Minute Drill as part of this, again, surprise drop EP. I think he called it Might Delete Later or something, or Might Delete This, lol, whatever. I'm not sure. Might Delete Later. Yeah, that's exactly what it's called. So J. Cole is throwing shots at Kendrick Lamar. Need I remind you that Kendrick Lamar's discography has previously won Pulitzer Prizes, right? If we're going to, if we're, and I like J. Cole. I say this as someone who has seen J. Cole live. I like J. Cole, right? J. Cole's like, okay, bitch, here we are. He calls Kendrick's most recent album, Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers, tragic. He claims Kendrick's second album, Good Kid, Mad City, put listeners to sleep. He also promised to humble Lamar if push comes to shove. April 10th, 5 days later, J. Cole's like, never mind, lol. Actually, never mind. So he removed 7-Minute Drill from streaming platforms. At his own festival, Dreamfield Festival, he comes out and essentially apologises to Kendrick Lamar. He says, I tried to jab Lamar back. And I try to keep it friendly. But at the end of the day, when I listen to it and when it comes out and I see the talk, that don't sit right with my spirit. Is it because you flopped? Is it because you flopped and it doesn't sit right with your spirit? Anyway, I digress. Drake, again, still perfectly silent, Q-ness at this point. Future and Metro are like, right, time for a follow-up. We still don't trust you. This comes out on April 12th. This time, you've A$AP Rocky coming in. A$AP Rocky is the real winner in this whole situation, room, because he throws digs. And this is what I mean when, like, if you're doing rap beef, I need you to be spilling tea. Tea needs to be spilled. I need you to be revealing children a la Pusha T to Drake, funnily enough. I need you to be, do you know, I need you to be a little bit, I need you to be telling me something that I don't already know, okay? So A$AP comes in, A$AP, father of Rihanna's children, you know, a very good rapper in his own right. On the song Show of Hands, he's saying, now obviously there are words in here that I can't say, so like, whatever. Men in their feelings over women, what? You hurt or something? I smashed before you birthed, son. Flacco hit it first, son. So people think that this is potentially meaning that A$AP previously was with the mother of Drake's son, Adonis, which he previously hid before. See the Pusha T diss track. But Drake has also been like flat out dissing Rihanna since they stopped dating, stopped sleeping together. Maybe they were never together. Like, the man has been so butthurt over the fact that she is now with A$AP Rocky. He's talking about the fact that she doesn't really sing anymore, doesn't perform anymore, can't really sing anymore. Pathetic. So A$AP was like, absolutely not. Shut your mouth. So he's on that. And then you also have The Weeknd. The Weeknd is on both Future and Metro albums, but on the We Still Don't Trust You album, he's talking about, at one point he says, I thank God that I never signed my life away. And a lot of people are interpreting that to mean he's talking about Drake and Drake's label, OVO Sound. So The Weeknd's always been associated with that label, but he's never ever signed to it. So people are kind of interpreting that to mean that. Then Drake's like, April 13th, here I am. Here's my response. And the song is called Push Ups, in brackets, Drop and Give Me 50. I think there was some speculation as to whether it was AI, but I think it's been confirmed that it's not, because he's been like, he's been on social media essentially kind of talking about it and indirecting about it. And this is where it gets silly, right? Because he then starts throwing digs at everyone, people who were not being involved, including Rick Ross, who he has previously collaborated with before on his best album, Take Care. Lord knows is that song. Go listen to that if you haven't. He, again, is like, Rick Ross had nothing to do with this. Rick Ross was sitting at home, presumably minding his own business. Drake turns around and he goes, this man turning 50. Every song that made it on the chart, he got it from Drizzy. So then Rick Ross is like, I'm activated, okay? Here's my diss track. It's called Champagne Moments. And this, again, I think Rick kind of won on this, because I'm like, this is kind of mean. I need rap beef to be mean, okay? So on Champagne Moments, Rick is like claiming got a nose job, claiming got a BBL. We love the Drake BBL rumor. That will never die down. So in my from my perspective, I think Rick kind of won that. But then you also have Drake kind of going back after Kendrick Lamar, right? He's having a dig at Kendrick Lamar for apparently wearing a size 7 shoe. That's a respectable size shoe, no? But he's also, this is where he kind of loses me, because he's having digs at Kendrick previously collaborating with Pop Axe. You have the likes of Maroon 5, Taylor Swift. Obviously, they previously collaborated on Bad Blood, which is kind of, I mean, is it a little bit embarrassing? Whatever, but get your check, Kendrick. And also, look where Taylor Swift is now. You know what I mean? Especially also because Drake has previously linked up with Taylor for a check. So, like, let's not pretend you're above this. And also, are there not a load of rumors? Maybe I started these rumors that he is on, that he's going to be on Reputation, Taylor's version. I don't know. Maybe that was a rumor I made up. I really, really wanted it to happen. But now, based on the fact that he's having digs at Kendrick for doing this, I'm not so sure. But also, people are hypocrites. So he could be having a dig at Kendrick and still be taking the money off Taylor. Who knows? He also goes on and he's like naming artists that he feels are now like above Kendrick Lamar now, including SZA, who signed to Kendrick's own label, Top Dog Entertainment. People also reckon he's mentioning Kendrick Lamar's fiance, Whitney Alford. The lyric is, I be with some bodyguards like Whitney. But then some people are also being like, no, that's just a kind of, it's a reference to the Whitney Houston film, The Bodyguard, obviously. I don't know. I'm just like, but like, I know Kendrick is going to come back and he's going to come back 100 times worse. Like Drake thrives off rap beef. I don't think Drake wins that often. He's winning in this sense commercially because this track is doing like better or whatever, but I don't know. When you think about the Drake Pusha T rap beef, Pusha T won. Pusha T won because how are you supposed to come back from someone being like, you are hiding a child? You know? So my winners in this instance, I'm going to say Kendrick. I'm going to say Rick Ross. Floppers, the floppy losers, I'm going to say inevitably Drake. If you didn't get a BBL, prove it. You know what I mean? Prove it. It's fine. And if you did, so what? But like, own it. You know what I mean? And J. Cole, because fucking heck, if you're going to come out and say something, say it with your chest, you know? Don't be deleting. Don't be dirty deleting, especially after, embarrassingly, we've all already listened to it and seen it. It was 5 days, man. Come on. Come off it. Anyway, what do you think? Am I wrong? Let me know. Do you agree? Maybe Drake is the winner here. I don't know. I think Drake's been in a flop era for a while, and it's actually something I want to do a podcast episode on it, but I'm trying to secure a specific guest that I want. So watch this space on that. Anyway, that's it for me. As mentioned, we're on the socials. It's @flopculture_pod. I would love to have you over there. I'd love to see your ratings. Please rate wherever you're listening. We're on Patreon, patreon.com/flopculture. You get 3 bonus episodes a month. You get voting power on what we cover. Loads of cool things. Shout out to some recent patrons. We've got Catherine M. Hello, Catherine. We've got Meet My Patreon. That's not a real name, but happy for you. Thanks for being here. And shout out to Megan L. If there's anything you want to hear on the Patreon, let me know. DM me. Email me. HelloFlopCulture@gmail.com. Coming up later this month, already mentioned the Taylor album discourse. We're also going to be watching After We Collided, the second movie in the After trilogy. If it's anywhere as bad as the first one, my God, I'm worried. You can watch that on Prime if you want to watch it in advance. If you also want the audio only for these bonus episodes, you can subscribe in feed in Apple. Some of the episodes are available to watch on YouTube. If you want to join us over there, we'd love to have you. Until next time, this has been Flop Culture. This has been edited by Adam Shannon. I will see you, hopefully, next week. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.